We're now on our 7th episode of the Agene podcast, and during all of our excitement to get this project rolling, we realized that we never took the time to introduce ourselves. So before we dive into our interview with Alex Chavez, we'll do just that. My name is Tyler Ford. I'm the host of the Agene podcast, editor of the Agene blog, and an outreach scientist at Agene. I'm super into science communication, and I'm always looking for new ways to impart scientific knowledge to people. I finished up my PhD in the biological and biomedical sciences at Harvard back in 2015, where I worked in Pam Silver's lab on a variety of synthetic biology and biofuels projects.
My name is Eddie Page, and I'm the sound engineer and producer for the Agene podcast. I've worked at Agene since 2014, but only recently moved to the outreach team. As a digital media production specialist at Agene, I look for new and creative ways for Agene to share information with the scientific community.
We started the Agene podcast to give researchers at all levels a new means to share their science and their stories. We hope that by tuning in, our listeners will get new ideas for their research, discover interesting career paths, and gain insights into new fields. All of the podcast episodes are hosted on blog posts over at blog.agene.org. So if you ever have any comments or questions on a particular episode, please leave us a note in the comment section of the appropriate post. We'd love to hear from you. Alrighty, now on to the interview.
Yeah, Tyler, tell us about our guest today.
Sure. So our guest today is Alex Chavez, who's a researcher over at the Beast Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering. That's just across the river from where we are in Central Square. It's over at Harvard Medical School. And he works in the Collins and Church labs at the Beast Institute, but he's also an MD. So he's the first clinician slash scientist that we've had on the podcast.
Well, what kind of research is he working on in the church lab?
So he's done a couple of different things, but primarily what we'll be talking about today is his work with CRISPR, and you'll hear all about that in a few minutes.
Cool. This should be really interesting.
So we have Alex Chavez here today. Alex, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us what you do really quickly.
Hi, I'm Alex. I'm a postdoc in the Church and Collins Lab at the Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering. And I'm also a clinical fellow at Massachusetts General Hospital.
And so Alex is going to be part of the Agene Advisory Board soon. And we'll talk a little bit more about what that could potentially mean for Agene and for him later. But first, we'll just go a little bit into your background, talk about what you've done to end up where you are. And so as you said in your little intro there, you are an MD PhD. We've had a couple different people on the podcast, some people with biotech backgrounds, other people who are going into academia, some people who are already in academia. So it's nice to have you here as somebody who's a clinician. So I guess my first question is, how did you decide to become an MD PhD?
That's kind of a tricky question. I guess I would say it's from influence from your family, which kind of makes sense. So my father and my stepmother are both PhD scientists, and my mother's family has like 5 physicians.
Okay.
And so both of them seem kind of cool. So I thought, started thinking very early on that I was going to get some sort of terminal degree.
Sure. Whether or not was there a push one way or the other from the parents?
Yeah, so my dad always pushed the MD PhD, frankly. Mm-hmm. I thought when I first started undergrad, I might go just the MD route, because mm-hmm. I don't think I really understood what it meant to be a PhD, frankly.
Sure. Yeah.
And then I joined lab, and I really, really love lab. And I also, at that time, met an MD PhD student that was in my undergraduate lab, James Morley, and he really impressed me with how smart he was, frankly.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, if this guy is that smart, I want to be like this guy.
Yeah.
So that kind of helped push me towards the
sure.
degree.
Yeah, so you thought it was a way to just like broaden your knowledge in general.
Yeah, I wanted to know as much as humanly possible.
Excellent. And so what was that process of broadening your knowledge like, I guess, in terms of like how difficult it was, how long it took?
Yeah, so the MD PhDs in America, in general, they're between 7 to 9 year programs. Mm-hmm. The way that they work from a just very functional, practical level is you do, at most places, 2 years of medical school, so that's mostly your book time. So you basically learn about everything, physiology, pathology.
Just kind of cramming the entire
exactly.
time, getting all that.
So catching everyone up on all the general science, but then introducing them to a lot of general medicine, organ systems, all that. Then you go and you do your whole PhD after that. And after you finish your PhD, you come back and finish off your last 2 years of medicine, which in those, in general, tends to be the times you actually spend time in the hospital, on the clinics, as being trying to practice as a physician.
Yeah. And I guess, is it expedited in any way? So when you were doing your grad work, was there like a set amount of time that you had to get it done in, or how did that work?
Yeah, so there's no set amount of time. So I went to University of Pennsylvania for my training, and it's an amazing program. If anyone's thinking about doing it, go to Penn. It's amazing. I would say they're a very good program, and they're very smart about trying to merge the med and the PhD side together. So some places, they're really two orthogonal systems. They don't even talk to each other. There's no shared credits.
Okay.
At Penn, it's very good. It's very inclusive. So straight from your first 2 years of medicine, I was also taking a few classes that were kind of grad school level classes,
mm-hmm.
just to get everyone kind of, once again, kind of caught up on the same page with the research side of things. Once you go into the lab, basically what you're told is you should stay as long as it takes for you to be great. And so that can be very varied. It's
yeah.
kind of open-ended.
Yeah, what is the definition of being great?
Yeah, I know. It's totally objective in my opinion. But in general, most people get done with that in about 3 to 5 years for the PhD side.
Mm-hmm.
And then they come back and they finish off the last 2 years of med.
Cool. And I guess what would you say was your favorite part of the process, and what was your least favorite part of the process?
So my favorite part of the process is clearly the book learning. I just really like learning.
So you liked that 2 years of cramming?
That is
the
so some people hate the first 2 years of med school.
Yeah.
Sign me up for those first two years of med school for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. There's so much knowledge out there. It's growing so fast. And because you know, when you do undergrad, you learn a lot of just like molecular basics. But medicine is kind of like the level above that. It's starting mm-hmm. to merge that molecular with the phenotype. And
mm-hmm.
it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And learning about all the quirks and how when you have this molecular defect, it leads to this phenotype. And when you see that connection, it's amazing.
Yeah.
So I love that. I wasn't the greatest when it came to going onto the wards
mm-hmm.
because I feel, I think for a lot of people that are MD PhDs, they tend to have done fairly well in classes. And when you go, so you usually kind of know the answer to questions.
Yeah.
But when you go on the wards, man, you have no idea what they're asking you for the first couple of times. And you're just like, what is going on? I see this person and they have like 100 things that could be wrong with them. What's really going on? It's just very, I think it was very overwhelming. And I think you feel like you have to know the answer to everything, but
mm-hmm.
you don't. It just takes a while for you to realize that.
Yeah. And I'm sure you got better at it over time.
I passed.
Yes.
So yes.
There you go. Excellent. And did you have a particular focus on the medical side, or?
So I think I was really drawn towards pathology in general because I liked the mechanistic basis of disease,
mm-hmm.
and so I think that was really something I would always try to understand whenever I went to any rotation. So when you're a med student, what you do is you kind of spend time at each of the major like classes of medicine, so internal medicine, pediatric surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever I was in any of those, I really wanted to know the mechanism of disease, and that's what really I was focused on more so than just kind of treating patients. That wasn't as interesting to
mm-hmm.
me. So that's kind of where my focus was.
Yeah, which I guess makes you a good MD PhD kind of.
Yeah, I hope, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, on the PhD side, what was your focus during grad school?
So during grad school, I studied DNA repair, and I studied it in yeast. Basically, we use yeast as a model to understand some of the mechanisms by which cells cope with DNA damage, and how does a cell manage to, because under normal circumstances, our cells are insulted every day with thousands of insults, just from exogenous and frankly endogenous sources of DNA damage. You know, DNA is not perfect. It has errors happen to it all the time. And you basically...
What's the craziest source of endogenous damage that I probably don't know about?
So water, actually. So spontaneous
really?
Base hydrolysis.
Mm.
It happens to you all the time. And it happens in every cell, I think several hundred bases
mm-hmm.
spontaneously just pop away.
Interesting.
And so your cells need
they
a way to solve that problem. But sadly, we need water to live, so you have to solvate.
Yeah.
So basically, how does the cell cope with that? And
mm-hmm.
it has to cope with it because you're not going to live if the system collapses that quickly.
Sure.
No, that's a very simple example, but there's obviously more extreme forms of that. So
mm-hmm.
radiation damage is a more extreme form
yeah.
of DNA repair that needs to occur.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very elegant to understand that.
Yeah. And in terms of your motivation for studying that, were you just really interested in the basic biology of it, how the cell deals with that kind of thing? Or were you thinking about it more from this can be applied later to dealing with people who have aberrations in their DNA?
Yeah, so it actually started off from a more kind of unusual angle. So during undergrad, I started getting really into aging research.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some of that research realm, there were some, so I studied worms, and there's a few examples of worm mutants that basically lived about 200 to 300% longer than the wild type.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really, really interesting because I would like to live 200 to 300%
sure.
longer than the wild type.
Yeah.
And so I started reading more about that, and then when I finally moved on to grad school, there's you know a couple of different theories as to why humans age. You know, some of them are DNA damage is causes of aging. Some people think it's epigenetics. Some people think it's telomere attrition. So there's these small little sequences at the end of our chromosomes that every time our cell divides, they get a little shorter, a little shorter,
sure.
a little shorter.
Yeah.
And basically, the lab I joined was very interested in understanding how do you prevent them from getting shorter? Because if you could you live longer?
Mm-hmm.
Or not even just live longer too, but live healthier.
Mm-hmm.
And so the DNA repair mechanisms we ended up studying, we started trying to understand them in their roles in telomere biology. And then from there, it just kind of, as all good science does, it mm-hmm. explodes.
Sure, yeah. And I guess, did you end up having any success in trying to increase the lifespan of a yeast?
So in the end, we didn't end up going directly to that direction.
Uh-huh.
We did have a nice story where we were able to make, so a yeast normally, they always express the gene that keeps their telomeres long, but mm-hmm. if you knock that out, just like in a lot of our cells, it's not expressed.
Mm-hmm.
The yeast telomeres get shorter and they stop dividing. We did actually identify a few mutants that made the yeast divide a few more times,
mm-hmm.
and we like to believe that that would translate into humans,
sure.
but today, we have not done those experiments.
Yeah. So I just need more telomerase and I'll live a few years longer.
Or get cancer.
One or get
two
cancer.
Will happen.
Okay, cool. So working in DNA repair, you learned a lot about things that are actually very important to CRISPR. And so your later work has a lot to do with CRISPR, and we'll get a little bit more into that later. Did your work in DNA repair inform your decision to later work with CRISPR?
Yeah, so I think it did. I think maybe it made me naively think that I could solve CRISPR problems fairly easily, but it's been tougher than you might imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So yeast is beautiful because a lot of the systems that are present in yeast have homologs in humans. The problem is that while yeast have one version of the RAF51 protein that's involved in DNA repair, humans have like five.
Yeah.
And that makes it a little harder to figure out what exactly is happening to basically allow cells to use certain types of DNA repair in humans. But it certainly has inspired a lot of the things that I do.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in the cases where we're now applying CRISPR to yeast, there it's been incredibly fruitful. And we
mm-hmm.
now have made really nice progress on doing some high throughput CRISPRing in yeast.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Before we jump into exactly what you do with CRISPR, the place that you've started doing your work on CRISPR was the Beast Institute. So you started at the Beast Institute, I guess, after you did your residency, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what made you decide to work there? What is the Beast Institute in general, I guess?
So the Beast is basically it's an institute within the Harvard system. Their kind of idea is that they'll look to natural systems as sources of inspiration for how to engineer biology. And you have really diverse groups there. You have some groups there that are using DNA to fold nanostructures. You have some groups there that are just looking at natural systems, like how do geckos climb on walls and can I steal those ideas
mm-hmm.
and engineer synthetic versions of that? And so when I was looking around at places that I could work, I love the idea that they're pushing because, evolution's been around for a very long time.
Yeah.
And they've solved some very challenging problems. And they also have numbers at scale that I can never achieve. So in lab, I can make 1,000, 10,000 plasmids.
Sure.
In nature, there's some bajillions of cells all out there sharing DNA, mutating slightly, that are trying to find solutions to novel problems. So
mm-hmm.
why should I try to guess what the answer is when someone's already done the experiment for me naturally?
Sure. Yeah.
So that was very appealing.
Mm-hmm. And you ended up working with George Church and Jim Collins at the Beast Institute. Were there particular projects in their labs that you were interested in to start off with?
Yeah, so when I first came into the lab, I thought I was really interested in some of the stuff that they were doing with high throughput modifications of E. coli cells. So there's ways to basically introduce hundreds of mutations into E. coli. I thought that was really powerful. A lot of things you could do for screening, bioproduction with
mm-hmm.
that.
Was this MAGE?
Yeah, the MAGE idea.
Okay.
So the idea that you would feed E. coli oligos and they take up the oligos and change their genomes based on the oligos, which
mm-hmm.
was very powerful. So I was originally drawn to that. In Jim's lab, I really liked the stuff he was doing with some of the cell circuits and some of his stuff on like noise.
Mm-hmm.
So, how is it that if you have 1,000 cells, each with the same genome, they don't express YFP at the same level? There's
mm-hmm.
something fundamental in that biology I thought was very appealing.
Sure.
So when I came to the lab, I had a bunch of ideas I thought were amazing ideas, and a lot of them didn't work out, as you might imagine.
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
But then...
I guess, how many of your projects would you say failed?
Oh, man, that's... it's tough. So, what do we call as failure? So the problem is,
how many did you decide to move on from?
Yes, let's say that. So, we can call it failure. Probably projects I was serious about. I think the first two projects that I really spent a lot of time in, both of them, actually, I moved on from.
Mm-hmm.
One of them simply became a patent, and I just kind of moved away from it. And
mm-hmm.
the other one, I think I just realized this is probably not where I should spend my time.
Sure. just because you thought it was taking too long, whatever.
Yeah,
it was,
I think I started to wonder if my solution was really going to solve the problem I thought was it was going to be able to solve at scale.
Yeah.
You know, it was working, but would I be able to take it to scale, which is what you really want to do, right? I don't want to solve a small, be only be able to answer a small subset of questions. Can I answer tons of questions with this system? And it didn't seem like, I was wondering how well that was going to work.
Yeah. And what made you step back and kind of think about that?
Actually, I would say talking to the people in the lab and talking to my wife. I think one of the best things about the labs that I joined is there's incredibly bright people. The people that are so bright that you're just like proud to say, I knew that person.
Yeah.
And talking to them, and one of my closest friends in the lab is John Scheinman, and we used to talk a lot. And I think John kind of realized early on, he's like, you know, maybe you should move on from this one, you know, because you have this other great work. At that time, John and I were doing some really great work in CRISPR, and he's like, you know, maybe it's not really where you should be spending your time. Maybe we should focus on this and really just pound it out. And
yeah.
I think, you know, he was right, period.
Yeah.
It was one of the best decisions I made was walking away, which is very hard to do.
Yeah.
Because we are not trained to walk away. We
right,
are trained
exactly.
to sit there and suffer for years.
But I think it does happen to a lot of people, too, that eventually, maybe you've put too much time into it by that point, but you do have to walk away from projects. And it's certainly not something that you see in papers, because there's always a story that says, I did this thing, then this work, and this work, then this work.
Yeah.
But that's not really what happens, usually.
Totally agree. And how many times is it that you start a project for one purpose, and then you kind of like pivot, you see a different vision.
Right.
It's never portrayed that way, right?
Yeah.
It's always portrayed, I knew from the beginning this was going to work.
Yeah.
And it's hard to do that.
Yeah. Okay, awesome. So once you moved away from those other projects, you started working on projects with CRISPR. So just give me, I guess, like a minute spiel of what your projects with CRISPR have been.
So I think just to get everyone back up to pace, so, you know, what is CRISPR? What is Cas9? So basically, this is a protein that is works in conjunction with a small RNA. When the RNA and the protein get together, the RNA tells the protein where in the genome it should go. And it tells when Cas9 goes to that portion of the genome, it'll actually go and bind it and then cut it. And so people have done a lot with using Cas9 to basically do a genome engineering, so to make it so they use Cas9 to destroy whatever gene they want. We were interested in using Cas9 to not destroy genes, but literally go to genes, sit on them, and then turn them on or turn them off. And most of our work to date has focused on turning genes on. And so basically what we did is you can take Cas9 and you can modify it in such a way that you remove its ability to cut DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So you make point mutations in it. So now the guide RNA still tells it where it should go in the genome, but now it just goes there and just sits there kind of like a couch potato, just hanging out. We then fuse whatever other vector domains we want to Cas9, and by doing that, we can make Cas9 turn genes on. And so what we did in our first paper is we basically made a system that made Cas9 more potent at activating genes.
Mm-hmm.
Our subsequent work, we showed that there's actually a way to make Cas9 be both competent for cutting and for just DNA binding by altering the little RNA that it works with.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've had new work where basically after we published our Cas9 activator paper, there is now to date maybe 7-8 other Cas9 activator systems. And we basically said, this is kind of crazy. I have no idea which one's the best. Maybe the one we made is total garbage. We need to actually test this out. And we basically went through and we tested out a bunch of different Cas9 activators and compared them all head to head to see which was the best. Because we thought it was really important, because we kept getting asked by everyone we met, which is the best activator?
Sure.
Can I combine these two activators? And we got tired of saying, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So we just kind of wanted to provide the evidence to people and let them decide.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I worked on was using Cas9 as a selfish genetic element.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk a little bit more about that last one in a little bit. Going back to so using Cas9 to activate or repress gene expression, why did you do that in the first place?
Yeah, so we did that because, number one, I think it's a good way to understand biology, right? So if you can go and you can turn on one selective gene, you can then see what that phenotype is.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to do that at a genome-wide scale, which Cas9 would enable, would be very powerful, because now you can basically take a cell line or an organism and overexpress that given gene inside of it and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's useful both from understanding what that gene does, but also could give you potential therapeutic leads. If you overexpress this protein a little bit more, the animal lives twice as long or is resistant to this disease or this toxic protein,
sure.
That's a nice therapeutic lead for you to follow.
And so when you were developing these, was there somebody who had a project where they would need something like that, and you said, oh, we could totally develop it, or did you just look at the literature and say, oh, this would be cool?
No, it literally started from what you said. There was, my friend John in lab was trying to use Cas9 activators to induce iPS cell differentiation, and he wanted to be able to use Cas9 activators to turn on any gene he wanted and see if that can turn iPS cells into other interesting cell types of use, so it can turn into cardiomyocytes, neurons, et cetera. And when he started using the original Cas9 activator, it basically gave him my like 0.2% neurons when he induced this gene that was known to be able to turn 100% of iPS cells into neurons. And so I kind of looked at that problem and I was like, John, I think we can solve this. And so that's kind of how it started. And John's like, yeah, man, you think you can solve this? Let's team up and let's solve it.
Yeah.
And we got together and the rest was history.
And how much more efficient were you guys at differentiating the stem cells, I guess?
So I think in the end we increased it by 20-fold, depending on how you measured the stem cell differentiation over the previous one. So we finally, you know, we were getting somewhere like 5 to 10% of the cells becoming inducible neurons.
Basically. And is he still using Cas9 to do that now? Or?
So I think so people in the lab are now still pursuing this idea of turning iPS cells into other cell types. They are actually switching from using Cas9 to just using straight up cDNA ORFs.
Okay.
And I think it's because the Cas9 activators still have a little way to go to get a little more potency. In our most recent paper, I think we show that one way to do that is to have direct multiple Cas9 molecules to a given gene, and that kind of enhances the activity. So I think one way to maybe readdress this problem is to now build libraries. We have multiple guides against one individual gene, so you really turn that gene on better.
And now that you kind of know what's the best Cas9 activator that you can work with, are there any efforts to try to improve it even further, or do you even care anymore?
So I always care. Like, how could you not want to make something better? I think at this point, I'm almost out of ideas. We published a subset of what we've done. I think I've tried about 200 different fusions nowadays to make better activators, and I've kind of hit a wall. We have a couple things that are working a little bit better that we're trying to see if we can combine them to make something significantly better. So I can get 2 times better activators, that's no problem. But I want to get another like log increase, and that's been very, very challenging. So the short answer is I'm trying.
Yeah.
Long answer is it's hard.
Yeah. And are you at a similar place with repression too, or?
So repression is just starting in our group, basically. And we are now doing a screen to basically try to identify really good repressive complexes that function with Cas9. But we're a long way away from actually having a final story.
Okay, there. Cool. Okay, so we just talked about your work with making CRISPR-based gene activation tools and repression tools. You've also done work with CRISPR-based gene drives. So I guess I'll have you explain, what is a gene drive?
So I think the simplest explanation for a gene drive is it's a selfish genetic element. So the way to think about it is that normally for every gene, you have 2 alleles. And each allele has a 50% chance of being inherited by the offspring, right? You either give one or the other. Gene drives, what they do is they don't like that, and they try to bias it that so that they're inherited greater than 50% of the time, and sometimes they're inherited 100% of the time. So they basically make sure that no other allele but them goes forward in the population.
And so is there a natural gene drive somewhere, and what is it for, I guess?
So there are natural gene drives. So one form, what you might call a gene drive, would be something like a transposon, right? So it goes and it makes copies of itself and it makes sure that the next generation inherits it because it proliferates itself rather nicely. There are examples of gene drives where there's a really beautiful one in Drosophila where it's actually a gene drive that suppresses the transfer of another chromosome. So it makes it that there's one chromosome that it wants to be the one that goes forward to all offspring, and it's able to suppress the other chromosome from going forward.
Okay.
And no one, I mean...
So when it's making gametes or something,
exactly,
it just makes it so they don't get...
That dude is going forward, no one else is going forward. And so, you know, what do they do? They're selfish genetic elements. They're basically, they've been selected for, and they're propagating, not necessarily because they cause you any benefit, but they want to proliferate.
So they exist because they proliferate well,
exactly.
Basically.
Yeah.
And so you and I guess Kevin Esfeldt probably mostly have worked to produce gene drives with CRISPR. And we actually have a blog post from Kevin Esfeldt all about gene drives. So first, how do the CRISPR-based ones work? And then why did you want to work with them?
All right. Yeah, so definitely I want to give credit to where credit's due. So this project, my work with Cas9-based gene drives is really a product of working with 2 amazing people in lab. So Kevin Esbel was a postdoc in the Church lab that really brought a lot of these ideas to the lab. And then James DiCarlo was a graduate student in the lab that it has really also really wanted to push forward the idea of trying to make gene drives work in yeast. Mm-hmm. And so I worked with them to really make this project go forward. The way it works, though, is so Cas9 can be directed to cut anything you want, right? Mm-hmm. And so what you can do is, if you imagine you have a chromosome and you insert Cas9 into the chromosome, mm-hmm. what you can do is, if you make Cas9 target the same spot in the opposite chromosome, now what Cas9 will do is, when the two chromosomes are together, Cas9 will go and cut the other chromosome in the same location where it's located in, the same spot where it's located in, and then that chromosome needs to repair itself somehow. The way it repairs itself is it uses the Cas9 as a template to copy itself.
Yeah.
By doing that, the Cas9 moves from one chromosome onto the other.
Yeah.
And so basically, that's a theoretical possibility, and we started to show that it's a practical possibility by using yeast as a model system for that.
And why did you guys start thinking about it as a theoretical possibility?
Because it seemed very powerful. Because once you have a system that's able to copy itself at high fidelity, it means that if you have one guy mate to a guy that has a drive mate to a wild type, when all their progeny now would be 100% mutant. Mm-hmm. And so that's not really good, because you can now associate whatever other cargo you want with that Cas9.
Yeah.
And so now you can basically push a genetic system through wild populations mm-hmm. very easily. In addition, you can just make the Cas9 destroy some gene that you don't want to exist in the
sure.
wild populations.
And
high efficiency.
I guess even in terms of generating like transgenic animals, that kind of thing, that's very useful, because getting a homozygote isn't always the easiest thing in the world either.
Exactly. Especially if you want to do like a quadruple mutant, right? Can you
sure.
imagine breeding a quadruple mouse mutant? Each
yeah.
allele is
yeah.
on a different chromosome.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck. How many you're going to have to breed like Pied Piper style?
Sure.
Gene drives would really help you with that.
Yeah. In your guys' papers, you talk a little bit about developing the technology for use in treating disease, things like that. What are you doing going forward with gene drives?
Yeah, so I think one of the major points we wanted to make in the paper is that gene drives are very powerful, but we need to be careful how we use them and how we design them in the laboratory. And so what we built in the paper was basically a way to make gene drives function in the laboratory, but if they escaped in the wild, they wouldn't suddenly turn every yeast cell in the world lack mutant.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of showcased a couple ways you could do that. What we're doing nowadays, though, is we're using it as a very powerful genetic engineering tool. So
mm-hmm.
we're using it to basically, in a high throughput fashion, kind of like you said, generate double mutants, triple mutants,
mm-hmm.
Just by simply having two different yeast cells, each of the different drive, mate them together, and now they both knock each other's wild type alleles out, and you get a double mutant very quickly.
Okay, cool. So it makes it easy to screen large numbers of mutants for a certain property.
Exactly.
I guess, can you tell me what particular things you're using it to screen for right now?
Yes, I think metabolic engineering is a really interesting area to push forward towards. I think there is a lot of times, you know, when you want to make more of product A, there's about 20 to 30 genes you think you need to regulate and change.
Sure.
Well, gene drives might be a very nice way to rapidly cycle through that. You can
mm-hmm.
imagine you have a population of yeast, each of the different gene drive, mate them all to each other, and now you can spit out a huge diverse population of double mutants.
Yeah.
Mate them again, spit it out again, you have a population of quadruple mutants,
sure.
et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And then you can screen that very quickly for
mm-hmm.
whatever phenotype of interest.
And it has super high fidelity in your hand so far. You've been able to get all the mutants you want as quickly as possible.
Yeah, so looking at any individual drive event, at least everyone we've tried is basically like 99% efficient.
Mm-hmm.
We're now trying to get it up to that crazy library scale
mm-hmm.
where you have like tons of drives
yeah.
all trying to swap with each other.
When you say tons, how many are we talking?
So if you talk to George, my advisor, and Jim, they'd probably want like 1,000.
Yeah.
I think we're going to settle down, probably do, you know, 10 to 20 drives,
mm-hmm.
and let them all shuffle and play with each other and
yeah.
see what happens.
Cool. That sounds awesome, actually. Actually, in my work, I did stuff where I was trying to increase production of biofuel-type molecules, and I did go through many knockouts. So
exactly, yeah.
It'd be nice to have.
We think this might be a really nice way to sample diversity incredibly quick.
Yeah. So, on the flip side, even though gene drives are super cool, there's a lot of stuff that you could potentially use them for. I'd say there is a little bit of healthy fear about them potentially being released into the environment. And Kevin's blog post, he goes into a lot of detail about the different confinement strategies that you can use in order to keep them from going into the wild. I guess, what do you guys do in the lab to make sure that a yeast with the gene drive doesn't get released, and how do you protect the environment, I guess?
Yeah, so I guess the one nice thing about yeast is that yeast in general, they don't do a ton of mating. Mm-hmm. So yeast spend most of their time in asexual reproduction, which in order for a drive to work well, it's got to actually go through sexual cycles because it needs to find a wild type to mate with to like destroy his wild type copy to push himself forward. Mm-hmm. And so if you're an asexual division, that's not a ton of that is happening.
Yeah.
In addition, what we did is the way in order for a drive to work, you need the Cas9 protein and the guide RNA that it works with to be spatially together, mm-hmm. so that every time one is copied, the other is also copied.
Yeah.
If you break up that association, so the guide RNA is in another part of the genome as opposed to the Cas9,
yeah.
then the drive basically doesn't work. Only one piece of it gets copied, and so it's kind of a terminal drive sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously, you got to be careful, and you know we don't parade around the lab with our engineered strains.
Sure. We're
kind of careful when we work with them.
Yeah. And I guess I have a question that I have for that too is, considering that there are sort of natural gene drives in the environment, do you think that there's some protection against this naturally? So even if you were to release something, would there be something in nature that would try to stop it one way or another?
Yeah, I mean, it's a cool quote, Jurassic Park, right? Nature
yeah.
finds a way.
Yeah.
So yes, selection pressure is amazing, right? And this
yeah.
is why I think the Vise is brilliant, because we realize that you can get inspired by nature. And so the way that nature's probably going to solve a gene drive problem is it'll probably try to mutate the locus so that the Cas9 won't cut it.
Right.
Right. Because it'll probably try to take a hit in whatever that gene is, just lose it mm-hmm. so the drive doesn't go into it.
Yeah.
And so I think when you enter natural populations and there's a ton of diversity in there, how well a gene drive works is still up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of ways that you can try to mitigate the natural systems getting past the gene drive, but to this date, we really just have no
sure.
idea.
And do you know if there's anybody who's kind of trying to figure that out? Or
yeah, so I mean, this is something that Kevin and actually a lot of other people are really pushing hard on. It's an awesome topic to really research. And I think there's a lot of really cool ways that natural systems will try to prevent drives from going through, especially drives that are very costly to them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you try to basically make a drive that makes something go extinct,
mm-hmm.
there's a strong selection pressure to find your way out of that, right?
Yeah.
So it's gonna be kind of fun to see like man versus nature,
mm-hmm.
frankly,
yeah.
and how far we can really take that.
Yeah. Definitely with healthy confinement strategies.
Yes.
Involved
along we're only going to kill things that are bad.
Yeah. Okay. So going forward, so we've heard a little bit about what you've been doing. What are your future plans for your work at the Vise?
Yeah. So I think future plans, it's a bunch of projects, basically. Carrying forward a lot of Cas9 stuff. I think we have a lot of nice, cool tools coming through the pipeline now that are reaching maturity. Like I said, some of our stuff with yeast cell engineering, I think, is really maturing nicely. Some of our stuff for repressors is maturing nicely. We're moving a lot into libraries type screening. I think there's a lot of potential that people haven't really done for with Cas9 libraries and high throughput methods for really making it easier for people to actually do screens with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some other novel areas we're kind of going into, some drug screening stuff that I'm kind of interested in.
Okay. Cool, and that's kind of broken apart from the stuff that you've been doing in the past.
That's right, yeah.
And I read, I believe, in your CV that you're potentially doing stuff with protein aggregation. Is that more on the drug screening side?
Yeah, exactly. It's more on the drug screening side. It's kind of a throwback from my undergrad days.
Mm-hmm.
So the worm lab I was in, they studied protein aggregation. They studied aggregation-prone proteins that are involved in neurodegenerative diseases. So like Alzheimer's, Huntington's disease, Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm.
They're all caused by proteins that misfold in our brains,
yeah.
and they cause neuronal death. And so people have used model organisms such as yeast to kind of understand what is the fundamental principle. How are these proteins causing toxicities to cells?
Mm-hmm.
And can we figure out ways to mitigate that?
Sure.
And so basically, I'm building a system to high throughput screen.
Mm-hmm. And I guess considering you'll be using yeast for some of that, will be the gene drives be involved in doing part of that screening too?
They probably will.
Okay. Probably can't tell me.
No.
And going forward, you're also going to be on the Ag Gene Advisory Board. I guess you already are a member of the Ag Gene Advisory Board. What do you think you want to do to help Ag Gene advance as we go forward? And kind of what ideas do you have to improve us?
Yeah, so I think Agene's mission is amazing, right? I think one of the things that a lot of people that are involved with Agene are passionate about is really pushing science forward, right? And I think that's what we all should be trying to do. It's not become as famous as you can so people worship you. It's really push forward human intellect. And so I think Agene has done great focusing on plasmids, but there's probably a lot of other resources that we really can push forward on. And I know, some of the things that might be useful is not just plasmid tools, but you can imagine tools like viruses, or actually taking some of the existing tools that are currently in the Agene repository, modifying them to make them more useful for more people. So mm-hmm. there's lots of plasmids that people order that have one selection marker on it, but it'd probably be great to switch that to a bunch of different selection markers, because that may not be the one you need for your system.
Mm-hmm.
I also think education outreach is, it's great what Agene's doing. I think definitely needs to continue doing that, right? And I think one way to also really innovate on that side might be kind of if there was a way that Agene could do kind of the Agene cut the fat out of protocols.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many protocols that we do that have 100 steps, and I guarantee you 50 of those steps are entirely useless. But like Bob, one day the moon was bright and he decided that he has to do
he
that.
He has to do that thing.
And everyone else does that. And how much time are we wasting, right?
I think transformation is probably one of the biggest offenders.
Yeah, exactly. If you ever read a transformation protocol from one of the companies, they say you have to heat check for exactly 45 seconds in this tube. Let me tell you, that is not true. But, you know, that drives people crazy, right? And there's so much worry. Not only can we make things faster, we can get rid of people's anxiety.
Sure.
Like, let them know what to really worry about.
Yeah. And we're definitely looking in more in doing protocol videos. So it'd be exciting to see what we get out of it.
I fully agree.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for sitting down and talking to me. I think the future is bright for you as well as for Agene with you by our side. So, again, thanks for sitting down.
Sure. No, it's a real pleasure to talk to you.
You've heard a lot about Alex's CRISPR work in this podcast, and we've really only just scratched the surface. Be sure to check out the Agene blog, our guide pages, and the CRISPR ebook for much more information on the different CRISPR tools that have been developed, how they've been used, and how you can use them in your own work. We look forward to continuing to improve the ways that we support researchers with Alex's help. In fact, we've already taken some of his advice and have begun distributing pre-made and quality-controlled lentivirus, and AAV, as part of our new viral service. Check it out over at agene.org/viral-service and keep your eyes and ears open for exciting new developments from Agene in the coming months. Thanks for listening to the Agene Podcast, a better way to share science.